Samuel chapter 14, we'll be reading more from that passage. Appreciate everybody's presence this evening. Appreciate everybody that came over to the potluck. It was good to spend a few hours with the brethren, and look forward to doing that again sometime in the future. Title of our lesson tonight is How the Lord Can Work for You. You know, the things that are in the Old Testament, Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, were written for our learning. And one thing that we can learn from the Old Testament is that the Lord is ready and willing to work for us, because he worked for many of those characters in the Old Testament. And we can certainly learn that from the example of Jonathan in 1 Samuel 14. It was Jonathan who said in verse 6, "It may be that the Lord will work for us." Kind of the historical setting at this time, Saul has been anointed the first king of Israel. And in his first battle with the Ammonites, he won a great victory. But things are getting a little bit sour now as they face the Philistines, because they were a very formidable foe. In fact, the Philistines had a massive army. They had 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and their infantry was as the sand of the sea. So you can imagine 30,000 chariots. That's be the tank of the armies of those times, and 6,000 horsemen. And Israel had none of those things. They had very few weapons. They had some soldiers, but very few weapons to protect themselves. So they're scared to death. And many of the Israelites have scattered. They're hiding out in caves and thickets and holes and so forth. And many have even went so far as to flee to the east side of the Jordan River. So they're in fear. And under these conditions, there's a big contrast between Saul and his son Jonathan. Saul has an army, but he only has 600 soldiers. And as we read in chapter 14, we find that Saul is basically sitting on his hands at this point in time, either scared or confused, what it have been. And then Jonathan, though, bravely steps forward, and he decides it's time to stop waiting. It's time to engage the enemy. So let's read the first 23 verses of 1 Samuel 14. "Now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side.' But he did not tell his father, and Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other Senna. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few.' So his armor bearer said to him, 'Do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you according to your heart.' Then Jonathan said, 'Very well, let us cross over to these men, and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us.' So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, 'Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden.' Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, 'Come up to us, we will show you something.' Jonathan said to his armor bearer, 'Come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel.' And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled in the earthquake, so that it was very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. Then Saul said people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone out from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. Indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth Aven. So I want you to especially notice that last verse. It says, "So the Lord saved Israel that day." So if we can find out how the Lord came to work for Jonathan against the Philistines to win a great battle, a great victory, then we can learn how the Lord will work for us today. Well, the Lord will work for us today if we get off of our backside. Simple as that. Notice in verses 1 and 2 that it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side. We're not just going to sit here. We're going to take some action." But he did not tell his father, and Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. So here's Israel in a crisis mode, and the commander-in-chief is doing what? He's sitting on his rear end doing nothing. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it, with our current situation today. Contrast that with Saul's own son, Jonathan. He's busy actively looking for the enemy and to engage the enemy in battle. He was tired of sitting. He was tired of waiting, tired of hesitation and indecision. So he made a beeline with just him and his armor bearer, two guys going up against the Philistines. So just a major contrast there between Saul and Jonathan. So the Lord worked for Jonathan because Jonathan did what? He first worked for the Lord himself. And he put the Lord to work by putting himself to work, and that's what we need to do. We need to put ourselves to work, and the Lord will work for us. So the Lord uses the courage and the faith of Jonathan to deliver Israel from her enemies. So the proverb that we often say, "The Lord helps those who help themselves," even though that's not in the Bible, in those exact wording, certainly the principle is taught here in 1 Samuel 14. In Matthew chapter 9, remember Jesus encounters two blind men. And beginning in verse 28, the text says that when he had come into the house, that is Jesus, the blind men came to him. And Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I'm able to do this?" Excuse me for not advancing my, I guess I'm in the right place. Sometimes I get a little offbeat here. So when he had come into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I'm able to do this?" They said to him, "Yes, Lord." Then he touched their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, let it be done." And their eyes were open. Too often we hear Christians sitting, hesitating, complaining. Well, the church isn't growing like it used to. We just don't seem to be able to accomplish much these days. Or I'm just not able to overcome, and then you can list the sin that is bothering them. Well, Jonathan was part of the solution. He was not part of the problem. He stopped sitting around complaining, hesitating, and got up and got doing something, got busy for the Lord. And that's exactly what we need to do. I'm not against organized plans. I've been in congregations where we had various groups and we did things and so forth. I'm not against that sort of thing. And if we ever did something like that here, I would support that 100%. But we don't need an organized plan per se if each of us will just get up and do. Stop waiting for everyone else, for someone else to lead the way. And as we say, take the bull by the horns. In Isaiah 6 and verse 8, you remember what Isaiah said? Here am I, send me. Or what Samuel said in 1 Samuel 3 and verse 9, speak, Lord, for thy servant hears. So we can make many plans, but for the Lord to work for us and for us to grow individually and as a congregation, for us to put Satan on the run, each of us individually need to get up and do something. Join the battle and not just sit around the camp and making plans. Jonathan knew where the enemy was, and he knew what needed to be done. And he got up and began the fight. And I would say the same thing is true of us. There's plenty of work to be done, both in a physical way and in a spiritual way. And we just need to get up and get to it. Well, the Lord also gives victory regardless of numbers. Remember what Jonathan said? Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. Why? For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. Again, the Philistines had 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and innumerable infantry. And Jonathan is going to go against that kind of odds. Jonathan essentially said, that can't stop the Lord, so it's not going to stop me. And that's the kind of attitude all of us need in the work of the Lord. He knew that he was not alone. He knew that the Lord of hosts, God Almighty, was with him. And we need to remember that as well, that one faithful person plus God is a majority in every situation. As Paul said in Romans 8 and verse 31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? My favorite scripture, Ephesians 3. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, in every situation, God is victorious if we'll put our faith and our trust in him. So it doesn't matter how small we are as a congregation, we can accomplish great things. I'm sure that if you went around to many of the large denominational churches here in town, or even the liberal churches among our brethren, they would look at us and snicker. They would say, what a pitiful bunch they are over there at 1301 North Enterprise. But in the eyes of the Lord, it doesn't matter. Remember what he said. Nothing restrains the Lord. Nothing. From saving by many or by few. So let's don't get discouraged that we're small in number. We may be small in resources as well, but we can still accomplish great things here at Westside. There are no restraints with the Lord. Jonathan knew that it didn't matter that they had 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. As long as he's on the Lord's side, he's on the winning side. So our focus then should not be on numbers, but on quality. Every congregation that I've ever heard of, been associated with, that began stressing numbers, ran into trouble when they began doing that. We can thrive and we can grow if we recognize that the Lord first wants quality and not quantity. Can you imagine what would have happened if Jonathan had the character of the majority, including his father Saul? What would he have told his armor bearer? He wouldn't have told him, let's go up there and attack these uncircumcised. He would have said, it's just you and me. There's no way in the world that we can come out on top in this situation. So we just need to give up and go home. And we can't do that, because the Lord will work for us if we'll work for him, regardless of the numbers. Another thing we can learn from this incident in 1 Samuel 14 is that we need to always be ready to fight. Jonathan had two plans, plan A and plan B. Plan A was, I'm going to fight them here. Plan B was, I'm going to fight them over there. But both plans, I'm going to fight them. He didn't have a plan C. I'm going to cut and run and get out of this place. And plan C is a plan that we need to eliminate from our arsenal as well. We need to be ready to fight the enemy here, there, everywhere, and anywhere. Jesus said in John 4 and verse 35, said, there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest. Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest. That remains true today. When we look out in the Bloomington area, there are thousands upon thousands of souls in need of the truth, in need of salvation. And we need to take the gospel to them. Well, when you look at that in the overall sense, it looks like a pretty daunting and impossible task. So how do we go about it? And it's very simple, one person at a time. In my years of work in Michigan, I learned, I think, some valuable lessons from about evangelism. One thing I learned is that the spiritual soil in this country is rocky soil. There's no doubt about that. It's difficult to interest people in studying the Bible. There's a lot of reasons I could cite for that. I think our material prosperity is one of the biggest hindrances to the gospel. There's certainly a hindrance because of modernism is so pervasive in this country. There's so many denominational churches, for example, that they don't even believe in the virgin birth or inspiration of the scriptures and all kinds of things of that nature. And there's certainly a lot of apathy. And then when we look at these TV evangelists and so forth, they have set such a bad example that many people look at that and they're turned off. And I don't blame them. They turn me off as well. It's also difficult in general to interest people in the things of God. Whenever the name Jesus enters the conversation, people get all squeamish about that, and that makes it difficult. But we need to remember, keeping all of the seed in the barn does no good. In order to grow a crop, the seed has to go out and be planted, and we need to plant the seed. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. We need to remember how the Lord measures success. You know, we measure success sometimes in the wrong way, because we measure it in terms of numbers. If we're not converting a lot of people, we get all defensive, we get all discouraged and so forth. But that's not how the Lord measures success. Let's begin reading 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 5. Who then is Paul and who is Apollos? But ministers through whom you believed, as the Lord gave to each one. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. Now notice verse 9, for we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field and you are God's building. We are God's fellow workers when we do what? When we go out and we convert every person that we meet? No, we are God's fellow workers when we're out there actively sowing the seed of the kingdom. That's how the Lord measures success. It's not in terms of numbers converted. It's in terms of the seed that is sown. That doesn't mean that we're not concerned about converting people, but we need to realize that we're going to be judged on whether we've sown the seed or not. It's going to be up to that person and God whether they obey the gospel or not. So let's not be discouraged. That's another thing I learned in Michigan. Even though there are a few people there are a few people with good and honest hearts, there are people out there searching for the truth. And the more we sow the seed of the kingdom, the more likely we are to find those people. The Lord is not going to work for us if we're not willing to fight for him whenever and wherever we can. Well, another thing we can learn from Jonathan in 1 Samuel 14 is to ignore mockery. In verse 11, it says, both of them, Jonathan and his armor bearer, showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. Now, I can't read this like I think the Philistines reacted. They said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of their holes where they have hidden. I can just imagine the way they said that was in a very derisive sort of way. Look at these poor, pitiful Hebrews. They've been hiding themselves in the ground, and now they're popping out of their holes. They're making fun of them. And then the garrison said, come up to us, and we will show you something. We'll show you a thing or two if you come up here. Taunting them to come up. They were mocking and bullying Jonathan and his armor bearer. And certainly there were a lot of things to laugh at, weren't they? To make light of. I mean, these people were hiding in holes in the ground. Here come two lonely souls of the Hebrews to come up against us. You got to be kidding me. That's got to be their attitude. Well, mockery is one of Satan's most effective tools against us. Mockery is designed to do what? It's designed to discourage us. You can't do that. That can't be done. You're too small to do the Lord's work effectively. You don't have enough money to do the Lord's work. You've never accomplished anything in the past. What makes you think you accomplish anything? Sure. And if you come crawling out of your hole and come and fight me, I'll show you a thing or two. Some people mock the gospel as well. I've heard this many times. Well, the Bible's full of myths and contradictions. And they mock that. And they say, you don't really believe that, do you? Don't you know that sophisticated and educated people don't believe that sort of thing? Well, you must believe that the earth was flat. You must believe in fairy tales. I've even heard this one from a lot of religious people. You can't possibly believe that you have to be baptized in order to be saved. How narrow-minded is that? I even had one religious person and his wife tell me, well, you don't believe in music, because I was trying to teach them that the New Testament involves, doesn't involve instrumental music, it involves singing. Well, you don't believe in music. And they were just trying to deride and mock me. Well, you Church of Christ people are the ones that believe they're the only ones going to heaven. Ever heard that said? I've heard it. So what is mockery all about? Well, two prize fighters do at the weigh-in. They mock one another, don't they? They're trying to destroy one another's confidence. What do at least some on two teams that are about to play the Super Bowl do? They engage in trash talking, don't they? And it's designed to weaken the will of the opponent. So faithful children of God are always going to face mockery, sneers, insults, and criticism. And we have to do exactly what Jonathan did. Ignore it. As simple as that. We need to keep climbing the hill and consider it as a sign from God of a great victory to come. That's what Jonathan did. In Acts 26, Paul defended himself before the Roman authorities. And what did Festus say? Paul, you're crazy. You're nuts. But Paul answered, I'm not mad. I speak the words of truth and reason. Well, another thing this incident can teach us is that we need to work hard to reach the enemy. Verse 13 says, Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him. Jonathan had to work really hard to get to the top of that mountain and to fight the enemy. He not only had to climb the mountain, but he had to climb it on his hands and knees. Have you ever walked up a really steep incline? I tried to walk up this incline in China. I didn't make it to the first guard tower. It was just too much of a climb for me. Some of the people in our group went all the way to this one on the top of that peak. Well, they were all about 20 or 30 years younger than me, too. Can you imagine Jonathan climbing up a mountain, knowing that when he gets to the top, to engage in a fight for his life, and not only climbing up that mountain, but climbing on his hands and knees? Just a picture in your mind, him crawling up that mountain. I mean, he can't stop and say, you know, time out, I need to take a breather here and get a drink of water. Because those soldiers are there waiting for him. So he was not only willing to go out and engage and fight the enemy, he was willing to exert himself in the process. And that's what we have to do as well. We have to summon the energy and the dedication that Jonathan had. This is my son's father-in-law, Rhody. I call him all the time the world's hardest working gospel preacher. If this man has money for gasoline, he's out preaching every day. I feel guilty sometimes when I read Rhody's reports because I don't have the opportunity to go out and preach every day. I wish I did, but he has the opportunity every day, if he can afford it, to go out and preach. And you can tell from his shirt there that when he preaches, he works pretty hard in the process. So we need to be willing, so to speak, to climb on our hands and knees to reach the enemy. In order to convert people, we need to get out where the people are. And we need to hold up the hands of those willing to do the work. If we ourselves can't go out, then we need to hold up the hands of those willing to do so. Like Aaron and Hur, you remember in Exodus 17, they held up Moses' hands during the battle. We need to hold up their hands as well. Turn over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians 4, beginning in verse 14. The brethren at Philippi were ones who were willing to hold up the hands of others in their preaching of the gospel. Paul writes, beginning in verse 14, nevertheless, you have done well that you shared in my distress. Now, you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. They were the only ones willing and able to support Paul in his preaching. For even in Thessalonica, you sent aid once and again for my necessities. Not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that abounds to your account. So if we're willing to support those that go out and preach, that fruit abounds to our account as well. So we can't climb hard and then give up and sit down. When Jonathan got to the top of the mountain after climbing on his hands and knees, what did he do? He engaged in the battle, and in short order, him and his armor bearer had slain 20 trained soldiers of the enemy. Well, we can also learn from this that we need to inspire our fellow soldiers. Even though Jonathan and his armor bearer personally had a great victory, they also did something very important. They inspired those whose faith was wavering, didn't they? Here's 600 men at the bottom of that mountain, and they're all afraid. But they hear this commotion, and they see the Philistines melting away. They're clearing out. They're retreating. Saul heard the report and quickly did what? He did a roll call. Who's doing this? Somebody must be missing. And do the roll call, then they learn that Jonathan and his armor bearer are gone. So one of the greatest things that Jonathan did was inspire these others. First of all, it inspired the 600 that were with Saul to take up arms and join the battle. And then when that happened, there were others that were hiding away that were inspired to come out of hiding and join the battle. So that eventually all of the Israelites who had crawled and hidden themselves away in fear actually joined the battle. There were some that even went over to the enemy side. And when they saw that the battle was turning their way, they joined in as well. So from the actions of just two people, a great many others were inspired to faithfulness. And the conclusion was in verse 23, the Lord saved Israel that day. Well, think about this. How did the Lord save Israel? He saved Israel through the faith of one person, and that person was Jonathan. He had the courage to first inspire his armor bearer to follow him, and then their actions, it was like a snowball rolling down a hill, and it eventually affected everyone. So I take away from that a very important lesson that we can't stand back and wait. We can't say, well, I'm not good at that. I'll let someone else do that. Especially when it comes to personal work. And that's another thing I learned in Michigan. Who has the most influence over people? Well, there's a certain circle of people that you have the most influence over. I call it our sphere of influence. We all have a sphere of influence. We have relatives, we have neighbors, we have coworkers, and so forth. And we have this sphere of people that know us. And those people that we know are the most likely candidates to teach the gospel to. You know them, the people in your sphere of influence, much better than I do. I don't even know hardly any of them. So you're going to have a better chance with those people. It's not that I'm not willing to help or others aren't willing to help to teach the gospel to anyone, but you're the first person that's going to have contact with them. So when the work needs to be done, we need to get up, go out, and just do it. Not wait for someone else. We need to take inspiration from Jonathan. Well, that's our lesson for this evening. 1 Samuel 4, remember that chapter. The Lord can and will work for you. He will work for me if you put yourself into the work for the Lord. If you're not a Christian, the first step in the process is to enlist in the Lord's army. And you do that by obeying the gospel, by believing that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, by confessing that belief, by turning away from your sins, being baptized into Christ. In that process, your sins will be washed away. Paul says that when we're baptized into Christ, we put on Christ. And the Lord Acts 2 and verse 47 will add us to the church, the body, the group of those that are going to be saved. And if you're a soldier in the Lord's army and you have not been meeting your obligations and duties as a soldier, you need to repent of that tonight. If you've been AWOL, it's time to get back into the fight. If you're here tonight in any way subject to the gospel call, we would encourage you as we stand and sing.
Jesus tenderly calling thee home, calling today, calling.